This is episode 85 of the 99 Forever podcast. I'm Eric Friesen, and my guest tonight is making his sixth appearance on the podcast. He's a contributor for HeavyHockey.com, Ryan Lotsberg. Ryan, how's it going tonight?
This is my sixth appearance already. Time's flying by, Eric.
Yeah, I think you're actually tied for the most appearances with about four other people now. So, yeah, great to have you as a regular guest on the show.
Yeah, well, I'll have to get on again sometime soon here, break that tie.
Exactly. First time we've done an episode since the season preview podcast. I'll have to go back and check all our bold predictions we did and see how many of them are trending in the right direction.
I think there's a lot of tape there that needs to be burned.
I mean, I think some of them might be doing all right, but yeah, we're still. I was talking to Bob about that actually at the game we were at, because I mean, it was great to see you guys at the Oilers game and obviously the Heavy Hockey Showdown last weekend. We didn't get the result we were looking for in the Battle of Alberta, but you know, just being at Rogers Place on a Saturday night is always a good time, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The atmosphere was fun and. I had great company sitting next to Kirk and Bob, and you were a seat over from Bobby, so we had really good company for that game. Even the misery loves company, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I went to the game the night before against the Wild, too, and I was planning to drive home to Saskatoon on Monday, but then we had that huge snowstorm in Edmonton. So I had to extend my stay one extra day, and it actually worked out because I got to go to one more Oilers game against the Kings that night, and they picked up a win, so I'm glad I got to at least see one win on the trip.
Yeah, that's definitely nice. That worked out well for you.
Yeah, and I mean, it would have been awesome to see the Oilers stay undefeated in the Heritage Classic jersey, but if I had to choose, I'm still glad they won the actual outdoor game back in October when the jerseys were first worn.
Yeah, they won the important game.
Exactly. Like, if I had to pick between a Battle of Alberta, I'd like to see a win in. That would be the one. And then on Sunday, we all met up again at the Downtown Community Arena for the 2024 Heavy Hockey Showdown between the Heavy Hockey Network and Edmonton Sports Talk. And I'm happy to say that Team Heavy Hockey picked up the win. Ryan, just first off, how proud were you to be a part of this amazing event again this year? And secondly, on a bit of a lighter note, how many points did you end up with that afternoon?
I was really proud to be a part of that event. It's such a great cause, and it's so amazing that so many people like that are on Twitter and that are Oilers fans just all rallied together around us and in support of the Sexual Assault Center of Edmonton. So that was really great to be a part of, and I was really proud of the fact that I raised $1,095 for SACE, which I thought I'd have trouble getting up to $300, but the fact that I finished over $1,000 and Michael said I was a top five fundraiser for the event, it's just really, really proud of that. So it was just a really successful weekend all around.
Absolutely, and that's great that you were such a big part of it. I know you were very active on social media in your fundraising goals. And you know, for the second straight year, the Sexual Assault Center of Edmonton was our charity of choice. I believe we raised nearly $50,000 in benefit of SACE. And Ryan, with the number of sexual assault cases in hockey increasing in recent years, how important is it to not only raise funds, but also awareness about the support that SACE provides?
It's tremendously important. I mean, yeah, hockey has a bit of a stain on its reputation right now with all the charges that keep coming up and all the incidences that keep being brought to light here. But it happens so much more often outside of hockey, too. And it's really important for us to spread the word about the work that SACE does and the products and services that they offer. It's counseling, it's education and outreach. It's just a lot of different things for victims of sexual assault. So all the work that they do is tremendously important, and we can't say enough things to support that cause.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And just like with everything in the news lately, and you know, the bit of the bad reputation that some of hockey culture has had, I think events like this are at least a start to repairing some of the image and showing that hockey culture can be different and can change and can be more progressive in making not just everyone feel comfortable and a part of this this sport, but also that you know, people are going to be taken care of and not worrying that incidents like this are going to be a prevalent thing moving forward. Because there is a bit of a dark cloud right now, and you know, there's still a long way to go, but I think that partnering up with SACE and having them be such a supporter of us and supporter of them for the Heavy Hockey Showdown was just a great thing this past weekend.
Absolutely. Like you say, this event is just a one small step in the process. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But I liked what Michael said on the City News report about, we want to show that that isn't hockey culture. Like, there are so many good people in the hockey community, and I'm happy that I get to be surrounded by the big bunch of them.
Definitely. And I mean, I think, like you said, you raised nearly $1,100 yourself, which is awesome. And I mean, that's going to help a lot of people. I think last year our goal was each to raise $100. Michael then increased it to $300 this year, and maybe it'll even go up more next year. And like you said, at first it might have sounded like a bit of a daunting task to raise that, but once you get started and seeing how many people want to contribute and help out those who have been affected by sexual abuse, it really adds up fast. And probably most of us raise more than we thought we could.
Yeah, it just shows you, A, the strength of the community that we're in, and B, like how great of a cause that SACE really is. And it's awesome to see just how the city rallied around us for that. And I know for me, it was mostly friends and family, so it was great to have the support of my friends and family throughout the entire process. And yeah, it's hoping for more next year.
And over the past couple months, you have been posting, as I mentioned, about your fundraising and fitness progress. Can you speak a little about your 8 weeks of training leading up to the Heavy Hockey Showdown and your goals moving forward with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So even prior to the Heavy Hockey Showdown, I've kind of been on a journey of self-growth and self-improvement. And part of that is my body, just because I live in constant pain, and I have lived in constant pain for over a decade now, and it has impacted my life in a lot of different ways. And like, it's impacted my relationships, it's impacted me professionally, and it impacts my overall quality of life. So it's something that I need to get sorted. And I've been wanting to do more training this winter and working towards that, but the Heavy Hockey Showdown was just a really good goal for me to work towards. So that I had 8 weeks, and I wanted to get to a point where my skating was at a level where I didn't feel I was going to embarrass myself like I felt like I did the last two times I played in the Heavy Hockey Showdown. So it was a lot of tedious work. Like, I just spent 2 weeks just on ankle mobility alone, just rotating my ankles in circles and flexing them in all different directions. And then I got into a little bit more with lightweight leg training, like mostly body weight stuff, but added a little bit of weight in the couple weeks after that. And then it was time to hit the ice, and I did some cross-country skiing as well. And I was playing hockey throughout this on a team that I sub with, and it was awesome just to see the little steps of the little pieces of progress that I made throughout. And I was very happy with the results. I didn't answer your question about how many points I got in the showdown. I got 3 goals, which I was very excited about. And I had lots of people say, like, Dash, I played on a team with him and Jeff Aide last year. And even Dash pointed out that I was looking a lot more free. Like, my skating looked a lot better. My family in the crowd, they said the same thing. Like, I just looked better out there. And, like, I certainly felt better out there.
Yeah, well, so. I mean, I had no idea that you were in that type of, you know, discomfort with your body for, like you said, almost a decade. So I'm hoping that you're, you know, feeling better now, and geez, like, you'd never know it from watching you out there, because you were probably one of our better players. And like you said, scored three goals. I hit a post and a crossbar. So, I mean, I came within a quarter of an inch of getting a couple, but, you know, glad that we had some other guys pick up the slack offensively. And what did we win? Was the first game, there was too many games. Was the first one 2-1? And the second one is when we had the offensive explosion. It was like 9-7.
I think the first one was 4-3. Like, my first goal was the 2-2 goal, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
But it was a tight one, that first one. And then, yeah, the second game, it was a good game. We had that offensive explosion early. We are up 5-0, I think, or 6-0. And then final score, I think you're right, was 9-7. Like, they made it interesting in the end, but we held on.
Yeah. Had a nice couple nice faux tilts as well, like there was the slap shot into the empty net by who did that? I'm trying to remember.
Glenn.
Yeah,
that was awesome.
And then of course Dursa had a little bout with his son too at the end, actually after the game was done. So I mean, awesome event all around. And, you know, shout out to Edmonton Sports Talk for being a part of this. They were a good opponent, and, you know, a lot of familiar faces over on that team as well. So can't wait to do it again next year and make this even bigger and better than it was this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, thank you to the guys at Edmonton Sports Talk. We had Dustin Nielsen, Tom Gazzola, and YouTube Trav on the ice. We had Matthew Iwanek and Lieutenant Eric behind the bench for their team.
So, like, yeah, we didn't have coaches?
We didn't need it.
I mean, clearly we won both games, but I mean, we should have been able to wrangle up a bench boss to stand back there for us too.
We'll have to put out an open casting call for coaches for next season. We'll start the conversation now.
Yeah. Yeah. Michael's got a lot of preparations over the next 12 months to get this thing going, but yeah, awesome event and glad to be a part of it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Great job to Michael and the organizing committee. That
Oh, yeah. Jacqueline, you know, wonderful lady, too. Just everyone. I mean, they did so much. Like, yes, we all raised, you know, funds for this wonderful organization, but there were some people who took a much larger role than the rest of us and put this thing together. So to all those people, stick taps to them, because it doesn't happen without them.
Yeah, exactly. You just said it. The event doesn't happen without the tireless work that those people put into making it happen. So yeah, a big thank you goes out to Jacqueline and the rest of the organizing team.
Without a doubt. All right, let's transition to some Oilers talk now. And 11 different Oilers players picked up a point on Sunday night en route to a commanding 6-1 win over the Pittsburgh Penguins at Rogers Place. And with the victory, the Oilers improved to 37-20-2 on the season and are currently 3 points ahead of the Vegas Golden Knights in the Pacific Division standings. And following their historic 16-game winning streak, the Oilers had an up-and-down month of February. However, they've now won 4 straight games by a combined score of 15-6. Ryan, before we dive into last night's game specifically, in what areas have you seen improved play from this team over the past week that has led to better results?
For me, the big thing is just defensive structure. Like, if you look at what they were, the amount of goals they were scoring in February versus what they were scoring during the streak, they're about the same, but they were allowing almost twice as many. Right. So, like, it's just the defensive play and the defensive structure. What I was seeing in February was a lot of disconnection, like a lot of guys running around and guys out of position. But they've tightened things up a little bit since then. It's like Chris Knobloch had implemented his zone defense. It was more of a box in the center, hanging out in the middle. There was they covet the slot more highly. Like, they protect the slot with a lot more urgency under Knobloch. And they got away from that in February, but they're back to that now.
Yeah. And I mean, look how strong the penalty kill was during the winning streak as well. I think it was 93% during those, the 16 straight wins. And I mean, obviously that's not sustainable for any team, let alone a team that isn't really known for that aspect of their game. I mean, give credit to Mark Stewart and Paul Coffey for getting that back, you know, to where it was, but we have seen it dip as of late. And I think if you can find sort of a happy medium in there where you're not expecting it to be over 90%, but you don't want to be giving up a shorthanded goal or a power play goal every game as well. You have to find somewhere in between that.
Yeah, you got to find a way to get kills. I mean, yeah, you're right that the way they were playing during the winning streak was totally unsustainable, and it had to come back down to earth for a little while, like a lot of things that were going on during the streak. And the PK is one of it, but they figured it out, and they're starting to come around on the PK again. So, like, it's a lot of it is puck luck, too. I mean, yeah, there's defensive breakdowns and such, and they lost their structure a little bit in the PK as well, but they've got it back now.
Yeah, and that was something that we really needed to see corrected. But, I mean, you expect the Oilers' power play to be either at or near the top of the league, and even if their penalty kill can be middle of the pack or slightly above average, that's probably going to be enough for this team because they should be able to win the special teams battle anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Like they can be in the top half of the league. That's going to be, I mean, we know they have top 10 potential. They climbed their way into the top 10, right? They had a poor start, got really hot. They were in the top 10 for a while. Now they're back out of it. But like we know they can be a top 10 penalty kill. So like if they can just kind of play close to their max potential, that's enough.
And as I mentioned, with back-to-back wins on the weekend, the Oilers climbed into second place in the Pacific Division standings. They are now 9 points back of the Vancouver Canucks with 4 games in hand. There's also one more head-to-head matchup between the clubs in April. So the Oilers somewhat control their own fate. Ryan, with 23 games remaining this season, where do you think the Oilers will finish in the standings, and who do you see them playing in the first round of the playoffs?
I feel like the Canucks are within reach, but I'm not ready to say that we're going to catch them just because I think the Canucks have been struggling a little bit lately, and they're going to pick it back up again. The top teams seem to always get hot in March. So the Oilers will, and so will the Canucks. And I think Vegas will as well after the trade deadline here, because I think they have a couple moves up their sleeves. But I feel like we'll end up in second, because I think Vegas is dealing with some injuries and they're not the team they were at the start of the season.
They lost again tonight too, right?
Yeah, they lost to Columbus 6-3.
Yeah, so and the Oilers played Columbus in a couple nights, but I mean that was a big game on the out-of-town scoreboard for the Oilers, because now, like we said, they're still 3 points up on them and they have 3 games in hand. So I mean, even if the Oilers lose to the Bruins tomorrow night, because that's a pretty tough opponent, if they can pick up wins the rest of the week against Columbus and Buffalo, now you're talking about being on an even amount of games with Vegas, but you're also 7 points up on them. So this could be actually a really big week in terms of playoff positioning.
Yeah, and in terms of home ice in the first round, right, Vegas had it last year, and they got the better of us. Yeah. I mean, however, us specifically, I think that home ice is going to be important in that first round series.
It will, and you know, despite losing that series, the Oilers have still done well against the Vegas Golden Knights the past 2 years. They won 3 out of 4 games in the regular season last year. And the one game that they did lose was in overtime, and then, you know, won 2 of the 6 games in the playoffs. So yeah, they ultimately came up short, but they were tied 2-2 with them in the series and were up 3-2 in the second period in game 5. Like,
I think they led in every game, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Like, the Oilers can beat this team. They've shown that. It's just a matter of, you know, closing out, and we can't worry about what they're going to do with the available cap space. I think I did see that Jack Eichel is supposed to be returning, so that kind of takes away
some of the cap tonight. Space.
Yeah, maybe he wanted to get back in there against his old club. They're not playing Buffalo tonight. Sorry. I guess that. Did they play Buffalo on the weekend? I think that was the game.
Yeah. They played Buffalo. Right. Handed them their butts on the weekend.
Yeah, it was 7-2 or something like that.
Yeah. But
anyway, like, you know, the Oilers can beat them. And let's not forget, 4 straight years, the Oilers have had had home ice advantage in the first round. And, you know, right now they're on pace to do it again for a 5th straight year. And that's something that we haven't seen in a very long time. It's been, you know, 30 years since they've consistently been a top 2 finishing team in the division and getting home ice under, you know, this current playoff format. So And it didn't look like we were going to be in that spot back in November, did it? So to have them in this position now where they're not only going to make the playoffs, and it seemed for a while like the wild card was going to be their only way in, to now that they might have a chance to have home ice against Vegas, no one would have predicted that back in late November when they were about 20 points behind them in the standings.
Well, it's amazing that we've caught up to them the way we have. But I think home ice is going to be important just so we can control the matchups, because that Jack Eichel line with Barbashev and Marchessault last year, they lit up that Nurse and CC pairing 8-1, I believe it was, at even strength. So what you'll notice that they switched up Nurse and Desharnais last night. They also did that in Anaheim in early February. That was the game after they lost to Vegas. And who was on the ice for the game-winning goal? That was the Nurse and CC pairing. It's like, I think it's something that the Oilers are really seriously thinking about leading into the playoffs and leading into the trade deadline here.
And I mean, that's kind of foreshadowing for a little what we're going to talk about later on in the show. But it was just a pretty solid weekend all around from an Oilers perspective. Like we said, not only banking points, but seeing the teams around them lose in regulation as well. And last night's game was also the 12th head-to-head matchup between Connor McDavid and Sidney Crosby. And while I think the NHL has started to do a better job of showcasing McDavid to American fans by putting the Oilers on national TV in the States more than any other team in the league this year, do you think having two generational talents play each other at 9 p.m. Eastern time on a Sunday night was a poor decision by the schedule makers?
It certainly wasn't ideal. I mean, at least they had the spotlight to themselves for the most part. They didn't put that up against like a Sunday night football game, at least. Like, they weren't that stupid. But
In 2016, the Oilers played in Pittsburgh on election night. So, pretty tough to draw much of an American audience to that when, it's the presidential election at stake.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I don't think the result in the game for the Oilers was any better than the result in the election, but I'll just leave it at that. Not going to get too political on this show. And then, of course, McDavid did register a goal and assist in the win over the Penguins last night, becoming only the 8th player in NHL history to record a 25-game home point streak. He also has 59 points during that streak and is now just 8 points back of Nikita Kucherov for the league lead in scoring with 4 games in hand. Ryan, do you think we'll see McDavid leading the league in scoring before the end of this month?
Given the fact that McDavid is so close and has all the games in hand on the Kucherov and the Lightning, yeah, I think we will.
I mean, if he puts up 8 points in those 4 games, they're tied right there with just about a quarter of a season to go. You know, you give McDavid that type of runway. I know he's not driven by individual accomplishments and awards, but he's an intense competitor, and you can't tell me that inside there isn't a little bit of a burning desire to, I want to beat these guys and win another Art Ross.
There might be a little bit of that, but I think his bigger concern is getting this team into the playoffs.
Absolutely.
And chasing a division crown.
It always is.
And like, the Oilers get hot in March.
Right? You know what I mean? Like, they kind of go hand in hand. McDavid, the best way he can help the team is by being an offensive dynamo, which he is. And so the wins will come with the points, is the way I look at it.
100%. Like, the Oilers usually get hot in March, and when they're hot, McDavid's usually hot, right?
And we know that these are his 2 best months of the season, statistically, usually. He really starts to ramp it up after the trade deadline, and then he's averaging close to or over 2 points a game the rest of the way. I mean, really, since he got healthy in late November, he's been averaging 2 points a game. So to sustain that for, basically a 40-game pace, I don't see it really dropping off in the final 20-plus games.
Not by much, anyway. I mean, he has a 6-assist game in there that boosts that average up a little bit, but yeah, he's still putting up a lot of points.
And like we said, like as of last night, with the adding another multi-point game, he actually pulled ahead of Kucherov in the points per game leaderboard. So he does have the highest points per game average in the league. And, you know, as long as he just maintains that pace for the final 23 games, he will win his sixth Art Ross Trophy. And, you know, last year when he had 153 points, McDavid was a lock to win the Hart Trophy. There was no one else that was even in the conversation. He was one vote away from actually being a two-time unanimous MVP. But considering that he was under a point per game earlier in the season because he was playing through an injury, his name really wasn't mentioned much in the Hart Trophy discussion. However, if he were to win another Art Ross this year, do you think that would catapult him into the conversation for the Hart Trophy again this season?
Well, it would certainly put him in the conversation, but I think the X factor is Austin Matthews and whether he scores 70 goals or not. It's like McDavid might get 100 assists, which I think is the more impressive feat. It's been done
absolutely
fewer times. It's rare that guys get 100 points, let alone 100 assists.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, 100 points is the mark of like an elite producer in the NHL. And I don't know if you remember this, but when we did the season preview show back in October, I predicted 100 assists for McDavid this season. That was one of my three bold predictions. I also had him getting 164 points. I predicted 2 points per game, and I still believe that if he was healthy the whole way that he would have done it. But you're right. 70 goals is a number that really jumps off the page. But if you look at it, 100 assists, as you mentioned, has happened fewer times in NHL history. It's also been longer since it's happened. 1993 was the last time there was a 70-goal scorer. There was two of them, Timo Solani and Alexander Mogilny. The last time there was a 100-assist season was in 1991. Of course, Wayne Gretzky, his run of 11 consecutive 100-assist seasons, which is ridiculous. But, really, hockey's holy trinity, Wayne Gretzky, Mario Lemieux, and Bobby Orr are the only three that have accomplished this feat. And for McDavid to also do it, I look at that and saying, okay, 100 assists in a season, he's in with arguably the three greatest players of all time, and he's on pace for 136 points. We're talking about back-to-back 130-point seasons and potentially a sixth Art Ross trophy, which has only ever been done by Gretzky, Lemieux, and Gordie Howe. To me, that's building a stronger resume for a Hart trophy than Austin Matthews just because he got 70 goals.
I don't disagree with you. I think what McDavid does or is doing is more impressive, and I think McDavid means more to his team. But goals are sexy, right?
I was going to say, do you think that people are going to get wrapped up in the number of 70 goals? And because if you think about it, 2 years ago, McDavid had 123 points, won the Art Ross Trophy, and Austin Matthews won the Rocket Richard with 60 goals, and that got the heart for him over McDavid. And even though I think he finished with 106 points, so McDavid was still 17 points clear of Matthews, but they gave it to Matthews for the goals. And I just wonder if that could happen again, despite the historic season that McDavid's having.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Like, we just saw this play out a couple years ago when Matthews scored 64, right? And I think there's a little bit of voter fatigue with McDavid. Like, there's going to be years where he deserves it and he doesn't get it.
But there shouldn't be voter fatigue. That's the thing. He's only won it three times. Let's remember, this is McDavid's ninth season, and he's only won three in his first 8 years. He should have won in 2018 when they gave it to Taylor Hall, but because the Oilers missed the playoffs, he didn't get it that year. I believe he should have won it again in 2022 when Matthews got it for scoring 60. So realistically, he should be at five MVPs right now. And it's kind of hard to believe that a player of his ilk hasn't won more than three. So I don't think the voter fatigue should be setting in at all. Part of it, you know, Matthews does play in a major market, and there will be Toronto voters who are eager to vote for him, and they will be feeling justified in their decision because he might score 70. He's a lock probably to get in the 60s at this point. He's got 53 goals in 59 games, so he's at least going to get there. But I can see how it might be slanted towards Matthews. But history, I think, will look back on this season and see what McDavid accomplished and think that it was the more impressive season. And it's hard to believe that McDavid doesn't win it every year. And I'm not even just saying that because I'm an Oilers fan, but realistically, tell me a year where he isn't the most valuable player in the league. Every year that he's healthy and in his prime, he's the most valuable player, in my opinion.
You're not going to get an argument on that from me.
Just stating my case. I had a feeling that you would feel similar to me on that. But yeah, I think that there might be some fans around the league that will, like you said, pushing for the goals and thinking that it's more attractive. But 100 assists is 100 assists. Yeah, the last time it happened was, like I said, 91. I was 2 years old. There's a whole generation, if not two generations of fans who have never seen this happen before. So, yeah, it would be a monumental achievement if he's able to do it.
Yeah, totally agreed.
And he's on pace for 104 right now. So, I mean, he might clear it and then some.
It's even more impressive because of his slow start and the injury at the start of the year.
And that's what I sort of mentioned, why I think that he should be in the Hart Trophy discussion. He was under a point per game at one point in November, and that's the first time that's happened since his rookie season. So to think that he has been at that level, right now he's heads and tails above everyone else as far as I'm concerned. Like, yes, Kucherov and MacKinnon have been ahead of the scoring race more of the season, but the ground that McDavid has made up over the past 3 or 4 months, the fact that he's in the conversation now for another scoring title, considering how far back he is, that I think deserves Hart consideration alone.
Oh, 100%.
And we also saw McDavid and Draisaitl playing on the same line for the fourth straight game last night. And in his first few months behind the bench, Chris Knobloch didn't play McDavid and Draisaitl together as often as some of the previous coaches they've had. But we've seen it a lot more recently. Ryan, do you think that this is something Knobloch would actually consider doing in the playoffs? Or what do you think the main reason has been for reuniting the dynamic duo this past week?
I think the main reason for doing it is because it's been working. That's the big thing. Like, I remember writing an article about this on Heavy Hockey earlier in the season. Like, I looked back at the last 5 seasons. It went back to it was the first year Draisaitl really broke out, when having the two of them together really became the nuclear option. You can't see my air quotes.
Yeah, but, audio only podcast, but we're visualizing it.
Yes, yes. But like, looking at the results, I was looking to see whether McDavid and Draisaitl were actually that much better together or apart, and if there was a second line behind them that was performing well if they were playing together. And I was looking at Ryan Nugent-Hopkins specifically, because he's the second line center if they are playing together. And like, the results were pretty 50-50. Some years it's better to have the nuclear option together, and other years it's better to have them apart.
And when did this start? When you started tracking in 2016-17?
I think it was 18-19.
Yeah, that was
I'd have to go back and look at the article.
That was Draisaitl's first 100-point season.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Yeah.
Now, that was also a non-playoff year, so I'm wondering if the numbers could be brought down a little bit by that season when they were a bottom 10 team, because every season after that, the Oilers have been top 10 or maybe just outside, like in 11th or 12th place in the league.
I was looking more at like goal share and shot share, so that kind of stuff. Like, I'd have to go back and look at the article again, but like, I wasn't so much looking at total goals. I was just looking at how did the team do when
they
the
were
lines
together.
Were configured that way.
Okay. Yeah, and that makes sense. And I mean, I've always said this whenever this conversation comes up, I think that they're better apart than they are together. Like, it's so exciting to watch these two create chances. I mean, how many grade A looks did the Oilers have last night? It seemed like it was breakaways and odd man rushes and guys left all alone in the slot for point blank chances. Like, when you put those two together, you know you're going to get some exciting hockey. But for this team to get to where they want to get, they're better apart than they are together, because it gives your team so much more depth throughout the lineup than just stacking your two best players and arguably the two best players in the world on one line. When you can separate them and have them each running their own line, I think it makes the Oilers a much harder team to play against when you can send them over the boards wave after wave.
I mean, there's pros and cons, right? You split them up, you can have one of Connor or Leon on the ice for 40 minutes a night. Yep. Right? Like, you got one of the two best players in the world on the ice at all times
at for any 40 time, minutes yeah. a night.
Right? It's like, from that aspect, it looks
pretty
good.
Pretty good luxury that not many teams have.
Exactly. But the other part of it is, when you do that, you take a lot of the other players on the team out of the game. Like, we lament the fact that we don't get depth scoring, but it's pretty hard to get depth scoring when you're getting 6-7 minutes a night, right?
You're basically asking your bottom three lines to just stay even for the night. Don't give anything up, and the top line will win the game for us. So, you know, I do like the idea of spreading out the talent a little more. I think it makes the Oilers deeper. And I mean, luckily they do have a lot of centers, so you can move Nuge back to the middle if you want. But he's played so much left wing lately that, you know, you probably get into a little bit of a rhythm of that position. The good thing is he can go back to it whenever he needs to, because he has been a center most of his life.
Yeah, for sure. I have no problems with Nuge playing left wing or center. Yeah, if he's playing center, though, he needs wingers that can finish. Like, he can't be the best player on the line. Like, it can't be Juju, Kara, and Jesse Puljujärvi.
Yeah, on exactly. His wings, you got to right? give him more talent to play with. But exactly. You know, when game one of the playoffs rolls around, somewhere around April 21st or 22nd, do you think that McDavid and Draisaitl will still be together, or do you expect that they'll be centering their own lines when the playoffs start?
I think they're likely to be apart when the playoffs start. I mean, we'll see what happens on Friday here. There might be more weapons for Coach Knobloch to utilize.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's a good idea too. Like, obviously, they want to upgrade the team. You have to. I mean, you're basically showing McDavid and Draisaitl, you know, sticking with them for a second, that, you know, you're committed to winning and committed to making this team better constantly. And you see some of the other teams around the league really loading up for a playoff run. The Oilers have to do that too. They can't just sit on their hands. They have to be staying in this arms race and upgrading the team, which we will talk about in a bit. But, you know, the Oilers have been getting a little more support scoring from throughout the lineup lately. And that was a big factor during that 16-game winning streak in December and January. Ryan McLeod had a goal and assist last night. Warren Fogle picked up a couple helpers. Corey Perry chipped in another goal. Even Sam Gagner, who had been out of the lineup for a while, had some good chances. How encouraging is it for you to see the Oilers getting more contributions from the bottom six?
It's huge. It's vital. It's it has been lacking all season. Even during the win streak, it was lacking. Yeah, like, Fogle and McLeod were getting points, but they were playing with Draisaitl during the winning streak.
They were. And I mean,
so, like, it wasn't like that was depth.
Right, but if you look at the even strength numbers, they weren't even that far behind McDavid and Draisaitl during that winning streak. And you do make a good point. They were elevated in the lineup when their points went up. And, you know, since getting, you know, demoted back down to the third line, it has dried up a bit. But I do think these guys are still decent contributors. Like, you look at Warren Fogle, he's one away from setting a new career high in goals. I think McLeod is two goals away from a career high. So they're guys who are in their 20s and, you know, still improving. So you'd like to have them chip in a little more than they are, but I think that they give you third line consistently numbers. It would be great if they had maybe one more driver with them so that they could produce a little more like they did when they were with Draisaitl. I don't know if they regularly get that on the third line with them, and that's maybe something that the Oilers still need to address, but I think that hopefully they can build off this game and it be a good confidence builder the way that they played against the Penguins and take that forward for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I mean, that game up against the Penguins is encouraging. I mean, like, yes, they have a lot of firepower, even though it's aging, but that was a team that's coming off a back-to-back that apparently had plane issues, and they didn't even board their plane till 4 a.m, yeah. I guess. So, like, they took advantage of a tired team.
They did, and the Oilers did play the night before, but obviously they got into Edmonton much earlier than...
Well, and that was a matinee.
It was right? a matinee as well, yeah. They played in Calgary a late one the night before. So, yeah, that was a big factor as well. You know, this sort of ties into what I want to talk to you about next, but Calvin Pickard had another strong showing in net on Sunday. He stopped 22 of 23 shots he faced and nearly secured his second shutout of the season. He's 8-2-0 in his last 10 games and has a .912 save percentage. Stuart Skinner was also sensational in a hard-fought 2-1 road win on Saturday in Seattle. He's posted elite numbers since November. He has a 24-6-1 record in his last 31 appearances with a .920 save percentage and 2 shutouts. And Daniel Nugent-Bowman from The Athletic was told by GM Ken Holland that the Oilers are not in the market for a goalie this week. And Bob Stauffer confirmed that on the broadcast last night. Ryan, how confident are you in the Oilers' goaltending tandem going into the playoffs? And do you think the Oilers should still be looking for an upgrade in net?
I'll answer the last part first. I don't think they need to worry about an upgrade in net. I think they've made it quite clear that Stuart Skinner is their guy. Like they started Skinner in all the playoff games last year, and that was the year after they signed Campbell to that $5 million deal in the summer. Right, so you go out and sign a big free agent goaltender, and then you make Stuart Skinner the starter in the playoffs or every single game. That's your organizational number one. Like, that's your guy going forward.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's going to be the case come springtime again here. Skinner's going to be the guy going forward. So am I confident in Skinner? Yeah, I'm confident in Skinner. Is he the best goaltender in the league? No, he isn't. He's streaky. He's inconsistent.
He's young though too. I mean, he hasn't even played 2 full years in the league yet.
Exactly.
But I think we're seeing enough signs that you could hope that maybe he could eventually push towards being one of the upper echelon goalies somewhere around that top 10 range. I don't know if he's ever going to get into the top 5, but if he can even be one of the better goalies in the league, like better than average, I think that, you know, that really bodes well for this team because they have so much offensive firepower. If they can get the saves to go along with it, then, you know, they're going to be well set going into the playoffs. And I mean, go back to December even, or even early January, when the winning streak was only at about 10 games, there were still a lot of conversations about the one position the Oilers need to address more than anything else is the goaltending. And that doesn't necessarily mean getting an upgrade on Skinner, but more than anything, getting an upgrade on Pickard and having a reliable backup that you can have in. But I would say that with the goaltending that Pickard has given them since he was brought up from Bakersfield, I don't know if they could find anything better than that on the trade market right now. And even if they could, would they be willing to pay the price for it?
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. Pickard's been really good. He's a solid pro, solid veteran pro.
He just looks so steady. Sorry to cut you off, but he just, you know, he might not make a bunch of spectacular saves, but he just makes the saves he's supposed to make. He looks like a guy who's played 13 years of pro hockey, which he has.
Yeah, 100%. Like, the guy knows what he's doing. Like, I was excited when we got him because I knew he was a really good insurance policy and we needed to cash it in this year, and it's worked out for us.
Maybe that's underrated how important it is to have a solid third organizational goalie.
Yeah, 100%, and especially one that's making league minimum like Pickard is. Like, yeah, you could go out and spend assets on a Jake Allen or a Charlie Lindgren or whoever else you want, but there's no guarantee that they're going to get better results than Pickard's gotten them.
And even if you do go out and do that, then you've left yourself very thin for being able to address anything else. And I really think if you had to make a list of areas where the Oilers need help, between the pipes probably is lower on the priority list.
100%.
And, you know, like we said, goaltending was, you know, a strength during the regular season last year. Like, Skinner had a much better first season as a starter than we expected. He was really thrust into it very early on in the Jack Campbell era after things, you know, quickly didn't go well. And he thrived in that position. The playoffs didn't go as well. He was pulled 4 times in favor of Campbell. And, you know, maybe you could have argued that Jack should have got a start one or two of those following up with those pulls. But it's hard to blame Skinner too much in the playoffs when they might have not even been in the spot they were in if it wasn't for him during the regular season. So I don't want to fault him too much. I think that it was just a situation where you have a rookie goalie, an all-star at that too, like a rookie all-star goalie being asked to try and take a contending team all the way to the end very early on in your NHL career. And like, obviously we said he came up short against the Vegas Golden Knights, but I thought that overall last season, I would still give him a more than passing grade because of, you know, what he did during the regular season alone.
100%. And then I don't want to be hard on Skinner for his playoff performance last year either. I think the team in front of him wasn't very good, especially against Vegas near the end of the series. There were a lot of breakdowns.
Some guys went cold too, right? Like, I mean, Zach Hyman and Nuge and Kane, like some of the important players on this team that were so big during the 2022 playoffs, didn't have probably the type of playoff run that they would have liked to have. And, you know, hopefully this spring it'll be a little closer to what it was 2 years ago when it seemed like everyone in the Oilers top six was on fire.
Yeah, I mean, we can only get so or hope to be so lucky again.
Exactly. But yeah, I don't think that that's an area that they really are that concerned about. I don't know what the summer holds. Like, they have Olivier Rodrigue, who is going to need waivers to be sent down next season. I was wondering if maybe he would get a start or two down the stretch once they have their playoff position locked up, just to see what you have in the guy. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what they do with that backup position next season, because I really think they're going to try to make a Jack Campbell trade in the summer. Maybe you have to give up a first round pick, attach it to him to get rid of the contract. But, you know, it's a problem for down the road. Right now, I think they're just fully focused on how we can make this team better in the short term going into the postseason.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they're definitely going to look to move Jack Campbell in the summer. We'll see. I mean, the Kings were able to move Cal Peterson last year, so it's possible.
I mean, you just have to find a team that's willing to do it and take him on. Like, okay, the San Jose Sharks are probably going to be bad for another 5 years. Would they be willing to take Campbell off the books for the Oilers? And especially because they have so much cap space too. Hey, take a chance on them. We're in Anaheim or one of these rebuilding teams, Chicago. We'll send you Campbell. We'll give you a first round pick. And that opens up $5 million of cap space for the Oilers. And the only bad part about that is it kind of limits you at the trade deadline next year that you don't have that first round pick to deal. But you could also argue that just getting that $5 million of available cap space back might be worth doing it.
Well, and you look at the fact that next year the league is, or the salary cap's going up by about $4 million.
Yeah, it's supposed to jump from 83.5 to 87. So, I mean, if you get that $4 million jump, now the Connor Brown bonus is going to take up a good chunk of that.
Yeah, and Corey Perry, too. So between the two of them, we're pushing $3.5 million.
Probably. So, I mean, if you can get that extra money back, that would give you the money to go out and maybe add a player in the offseason or even just re-sign some of the guys that you're going to need to re-up as well.
Exactly, and we're looking at rentals at the deadline here, and you're probably going to want to get a chance to retain them if you can because of the assets you're going to have to give up to get them, and you need cap space next year to do that.
Without a doubt. All right, let's dive into some trade talk now, and according to Bob Stauffer, the Oilers are looking to add as many as three players before Friday's deadline. Ideally, they would like to acquire one top six forward, one bottom six forward, and one top four defenseman this week. And again, it will have to be a money-in, money-out situation due to the Oilers only having about $2 million in available cap space. So tonight we're going to run through Ryan's top five Oilers trade targets, what he thinks the acquisition cost would be for each of these players, and where they would ultimately fit in the lineup if the Oilers were to trade for them. So let's start with number five on your trade targets list, Nick Dowd from the Washington Capitals. Dowd is a right shot center. He's 33 years old. He's 6'1" and 193 pounds. He has 8 goals and 16 points in 45 games this season, and he carries a $1.3 million cap hit and is signed through the 2024-25 season. Ryan, what do you think the Capitals would be looking for in exchange for Dowd?
Well, I know the Caps are looking to get younger. They want to get younger players onto their roster. So they're going to be looking for, obviously, young players that are either contributing or very close to contributing. So I think that it's going to cost something around Raphael Lavoie and a third-round pick.
And how do you feel about giving up on a prospect the Oilers have been developing for 5 years now, as Lavoie was a 2019 draft pick, to make Dowd work? Is it worth it to give up on a guy who has a great shot, just hasn't been able to make it in the NHL yet, for a bottom six forward for the rest of this season and next?
I mean, I really like Lavoie as a player. I was impressed with his preseason, and he didn't do much with his opportunity at the NHL level this year. Yeah, he didn't get many minutes either, but he really didn't do a lot out there. But it all depends on where the team's at in their competitive cycle here. And the Oilers are in win-now mode. And the other thing of it is, when Jeff Jackson came in this summer, one of the first things that he did was he fired Tyler Wright,
right,
the head of amateur scouting, right? So I think that right there is a sign that they're not,
He's not married to any prospect.
Any,
yeah, I was just about exactly. to say that. And Raphael Lavoie was one of Wright's first draft picks with Edmonton. And I'll be honest, he was a prospect that I've had high hopes for. And, you know, he was a great scorer in junior. He got better every year. His goals per game average continued to go up. And even in the minors, we've seen him start to, you know, make some strides. I think he's close to 20 goals on this season now. He had 25 last season. But yeah, you're right. He just hasn't been able to find a foothold in the NHL. So if you can bring in a guy who can make the Oilers better right now, as opposed to a player who could help you down the road, then it's probably a trade that you're willing to make.
And there's going to be suitors for Nick Dowd. Like, he does a lot of good things, but the big thing is it's a $1.3 million cap hit, which is really reasonable, right. And he signed through next year. So, like, that extra year has GMs salivating over Nick Dowd. So it's going to – you got to give something up to get a guy like Dowd right now that you think can help you win a championship. And, yeah, I like Lavoie. He's a prospect that I also had high hopes for, but that's the cost of doing business.
True. And what do you think makes Dowd a good fit for this team, and where do you see him slotting into the lineup?
Dowd is such a good fit because he's basically a coach's dream. Like, he's responsible defensively. He's good on the faceoffs. I mean, this is the third year of his career where he's under 50%. And I mean, the guy's 31 years old. He's been around for a while, and he's not even that far under 50% this year. So he's been consistently good at draws throughout his whole career, and he kills penalties. So I view him as a younger, bigger, faster, stronger version of Derek Ryan.
Yeah, and I mean, if he can fill the Derek Ryan slot, that would be perfect. And I'll give Derek Ryan credit. He has been a solid bottom six contributor for the past 2 years. I think he has better than average skill for a fourth liner. He does a lot of the things you listed that Dowd can do, but we have seen a drop in his play this season. He did turn 37 back in December, and if they can bring up an upgrade on him to the Oilers roster, then I would be in full favor of it, because you know, that fourth line doesn't get many minutes, and maybe with Dowd sliding in there, you can trust that line out there a little more often.
Yeah, and like, we don't have a true legitimate fourth line center right now. Like, Ryan has played center in the past, but he doesn't have the boots for that anymore. Matthias Janmark has played center in the past, but same idea. Doesn't quite have the boots for that anymore. You got Dylan Holloway, who they're trying to experiment with at center, and I don't mind that, but he's been a winger at the NHL level. So just to have a solid, reliable veteran anchoring that fourth line, that's another right-hand shot that can win faceoffs. I think that's an important piece that the Oilers have been looking for a couple years now.
Definitely. Okay, moving on to number four on your list, Alexander Carrier from the Nashville Predators. Carrier is a right-shot defenseman. He's 27 years old. He's 5'11" and 174 pounds. He has 4 goals and 19 points in 57 games this season, and he carries a $2.5 million cap hit and can become a UFA on July 1st. Ryan, what assets would the Oilers have to send out to bring in Carrier?
I see three pieces going the other way here. One's got to be Cody Ceci to make the money work and to open up the roster spot. I think it's going to take a third-round pick. And I think it's going to take a defense prospect, which in this case, I think is going to be Phil Kemp.
Yeah, I mean, you know, give a credit to Kemp as well. He got in one NHL game this year, sort of as a reward for being a good soldier down there in the minors the last few years. Only played 3 minutes in Montreal, but, you know, still a night that he'll never forget. And, you know, some fans might be a little apprehensive about sending out another defensive prospect because of last year, the Oilers trading Michael Kesselring, who is now playing a regular role for the Coyotes. And, you know, obviously it'd be great to have him pushing for a spot in the Oilers lineup this year instead, but that was the cost of doing business to bring in Nick Bjugstad, and I thought that he was an excellent addition to the team, so I would still do that trade over again. And, you know, if the Oilers do have to give up Phil Kemp, I don't think that's the end of the world. He's not viewed as one of the Oilers', you know, top defensive prospects. If it was something where they had to include a Max Wanner or a Bo Akey, then I would reject a trade like that.
Yeah, timing is everything. Like, Phil Kemp is an older prospect. Right. And we're at that time where...
I think he's 23 or 24 now.
Yeah, maybe even older. I don't know. But it's sink or swim. And, like, he's gotten 2 minutes of NHL ice time.
Yeah. Right? And maybe so, he makes a team that is more in rebuilding mode than trying to crack a roster that's pushing for a Stanley Cup. That's a tough challenge for a young defenseman. And, you know, that's what gives some of their higher end defensive prospects more time to, you know, season in the minors or even in junior, because they don't need to be cracking this roster right away.
Well, exactly. Like, we're in win now mode. We've got CeCe for another year. And if we get Carrier or even Sean Walker, right, we're hoping to have them for a number of years if we're able to retain them. So, like, they're going to have time to develop Bo Akey and a Max Wanner. The timing just isn't right for Kemp and the Oilers, unfortunately. So, again, good prospect. I like Phil Kemp, but... I don't see a future for him in an Oiler uniform.
No, neither do I. And with Evan Bouchard and Matthias Ekholm seemingly set in stone as a defensive pairing, Carey would slide in next to Darnell Nurse as the CeCe replacement, wouldn't he?
Oh, absolutely. He would. Absolutely.
And, I mean, if you look at the Oilers' blue line, I think they have three really solid top four defensemen in Nurse, Bouchard, and Ekholm, but how much better does Carrier really make this back end?
He's definitely an upgrade on CeCe, but honestly, I don't think it's a significant upgrade. Like, I don't think Cody CeCe gets enough credit for what he's doing. I'm not saying Cody CeCe is amazing, but he's treading water at 5-on-5, and he's ranked... Like, his $3.25 million contract is 108th out of 128 top four contracts, right? Like, it's the 108th highest contract for defensemen in the league. So he's at the very low end of top four D, and I'm sure there are top four D in the league that are worse than him. Right.
Yeah.
So I think you're getting decent value for Cody CeCe for what he's done with the Oilers, hanging out on the top pairing for his first season here and then being a top four D that's been spotty at times, but mostly decent. So, like, I'd obviously like to see an upgrade on CeCe. Otherwise, Carrier wouldn't have made my list. But I don't see any of the available right-handed defensemen as significant upgrades on CeCe. Upgrades, yes. Significant ones, not necessarily.
And because he's 5'11", he's one of the smaller defensemen that would be on this team. Actually, I mean, I think he would be the smallest, because they have three pretty big boys in, like, as we said, in the top four, and even with Desharnais at 6'7" being the biggest on the third pairing. So, you know, is there any concern for you about having a smaller defenseman like him when you go up against a team like Dallas or Colorado or Vancouver or Vegas in the playoffs?
I mean, yeah, that's going to be the thing that everybody points to here. I mean, 174 pounds, like, he's not just small, like, he's small. Mm-hmm. But you got to remember, he gets all the tough work in Nashville. Like, he gets over 40% of his ice time against elite defenders. It's not Roman Josi doing the heavy lifting. It's Alexander Carrier. And even last year, he played over 400 minutes with Matthias Ekholm on a shutdown pairing in Nashville. And he does it fairly well. So, yeah, size is a thing, but he has success. So why is he having success? It's because he's a good skater and he's a smart hockey player.
Yeah, at that size, you pretty much need to be fairly fleet-footed, and that's what the Oilers would need to defend the rush against some of those teams when they have so many top attackers. And also, I mean, his comfortability with having a former teammate in Ekholm would probably ease his transition coming into a new dressing room, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure it would. And I'm sure Ken Holland has probably been in Mattias Ekholm's ear about Carrier, just doing his due diligence ahead of the trade deadline here.
Yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense that he would. And I think even Ekholm might enjoy it, having a former teammate come in here as well. All right, let's move on to number three on your list, Tyler Toffoli from the New Jersey Devils. Toffoli is a quality scoring right winger. He's 31 years old. He's 6 foot and 203 pounds. He has 26 goals and 44 points in 60 games this season. And he carries a $4.25 million cap hit and can become a UFA on July 1st. And Ryan, this is a player Oilers fans are very familiar with. He spent a lot of years with the LA Kings, and he was a member of the Calgary Flames during the 2022 playoff series against the Oilers. What do you think the acquisition cost would be for Toffoli?
I honestly don't think it's going to be as high as some people might think it is. You got to remember, he was traded for Yegor Sharangovich, who hadn't broken out yet, and a third-round pick last summer. So, I mean, the Devils don't have to move Toffoli here, so they can play a little hardball, drive the price up a little bit, but I don't think it's going to be ridiculously high. So I think it's going to take a roster player, and that player is going to be Fogel, because he's the only one that we can really afford to lose right now, and he would make the money work. I think it's going to take a second round pick. And if we need to do any sort of salary retention in that deal, I think they'll need to tack on another pick, which I would put as the 2025 fourth rounder.
And I wouldn't mind if they did retain some of the salary, but like you said, if Fogel is going out, they probably have the money to make it work just with the cap that they've accrued leading up to the deadline. So if they can keep a little bit of the money, that probably gives the Oilers more flexibility to go out and make another deal. And, you know, if Stauffer is right that the Oilers are looking to bring in up to three players, then, you know, every dollar that they have counts. And the trio of McDavid, Hyman, and Nugent Hopkins has arguably been the best line in the NHL this season. And if Holland was able to acquire Toffoli and put him on a line with Draisaitl and Kane, would that give the Oilers the best top six in the league as well?
I would say so. I mean, you got the best two players in the world in that group already, and you're surrounding them with, if you added a guy like a Toffoli or another top six winger, you're giving that duo four guys who can easily score over 30 goals.
Well, every single top six forward on the Oilers would be a current or former 30 goal scorer at that point. And I mean, you'd have to go around the league and count how many teams can say that, but I don't know if there's that many where every single guy has scored 30 before.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. Like, most teams have a guy like a Fogel where he's a middle six, but probably miscast as a top six. You got somebody that's playing higher in the lineup than they probably should be, just because it's hard to load up and get six true top six forwards.
But the Oilers would have it. And when two of your top six forwards are former scoring champions and MVPs, that makes your group even stronger. And Ryan, Toffoli scored a career-high 34 goals last season with the Flames. He's on pace for 35 this year. Like we said, adding a 30-goal guy to the third highest scoring team in the league would make the Oilers even more lethal. But do you think they have any chance of re-signing him, or would this just be a pure rental?
I think there's a bit of a chance of them re-signing him. Like, you got to remember, he's 31 years old, so he's not exactly, like, he's at the end of his prime years. So, like, I don't see him cashing in on a $6-8 million deal. So, like, I think he's going to be in that $4-5 million range again, likely a short-term deal. So, yeah, I think that's absolutely doable for the Oilers next year.
Yeah, and I mean, if they could bring him back, it'd be great. And like we said, he's on pace for 35 goals, and that's without playing with a player like Leon Draisaitl. If he gets to play with a Draisaitl or a McDavid consistently, and maybe even works his way onto the power play, I don't know how he squeezes on there. But I mean, it would probably have to be if there was an injury, because, I mean, it's hard to take Zach Hyman off or Nuge off. So that'd be a tough spot, but it just shows you that you can trust that second unit even more. And we've seen the Oilers' second power play unit get more time than in any of the past five seasons. The Oilers' top unit was used to playing the full 2 minutes. Now you see Knobloch pulling them off after about 70 seconds and giving about 40 seconds or 50 seconds to the second unit. So it makes you a lot stronger when you can throw out like an Evander Kane and a Tyler Toffoli on that second unit.
Yeah, absolutely. It just adds more depth to that second unit. But you're right, I don't think he's going to get a lot of power play time. And that's why I'm targeting guys, A, that know that can finish, because we need more scoring on Leon's wing. And Toffoli has that. He's at a 14.7% shooting percentage this year, which is well above league average. He's 11.5% for his career, which is above league average. But he's at 30 even strength points this year. Yeah. Which among all the available forwards, that puts him fourth.
You on want the guys list. Who can score at 5-on-5 for sure. And because the only way you really get into the upper echelon of offensive producers on the Oilers is if you are on that top power play unit. But the fact that he has 26 goals already and there's still a quarter of the season to go, you know, that's the kind of guy who you could really see fitting in well with this team. And like I said, making them even more dangerous offensively.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's move on to number two on your list, Pavel Buchnevich from the St. Louis Blues. Buchnevich is a dynamic two-way left winger. He's 28 years old. He's 6'1" and 196 pounds. He has 24 goals and 48 points in 58 games this season, and he carries a $5.8 million cap hit and is signed through the 2024-25 season. Ryan, what type of package would the Oilers have to put together to bring in Buchnevich this week?
It would be a very expensive and painful package. I like Buchnevich, but I don't see this happening, but he's this high on my list because he is such a good player and he would be such a good fit. But the reported ask from the Blues is a first rounder and two prospects, and then it's going to be similar to the Lindholm deal where there was a roster player involved as well. So we're looking at a 2024 first rounder. We're looking at probably Warren Fogle as the roster player.
Just to always make the money work because he's an expensive bottom sixer.
Exactly. But like, there's still going to be two prospects here. And if you think that we're going to give them Matvei Petrov or Ty Tulio, you're dreaming. These guys are going to want Dylan Holloway and Philip Broberg. They want our best prospects.
I would include Broberg in it. I wouldn't do Holloway. I think that's too much. You're already getting the first round pick and we're giving them an active player. Including Holloway too, I would have to walk away from that one because I think that this is a guy who can help you for the next decade and we're seeing him slowly start to take steps. Like, there is a player there. And if he gets more time, maybe eventually he gets a look in the top six. Other teams around the league are giving these young players opportunities. If Holloway next season gets a real chance to play on one of the two skilled lines, then we could see him take off as well. And that would be one where I wouldn't want to touch. I wouldn't trade Bo Akey either. I'm a fan of a lot of these guys in the Condors, even the ones who haven't really had an offensive breakout yet. But, you know, if they had to move a Matvei Petrov or an Xavier Borgo, then I could be willing to part with them, but not for Akey or Holloway.
And I agree with you, and I think that the Oilers are going to agree with you as well. I'm not even sure that Buchnevich is going to move for that very reason. Like, Doug Armstrong knows what he has in Buchnevich. He's got a point per game player that's assigned through next year at a somewhat reasonable cap hit at 5.8, and the Blues do not have to move him right now. Like, it's not a disgruntled player. It's just like they could get a premium package from it at the deadline here. They might think about it, but if they're not getting the package that they want, then they're not going to move him. And right. Like I say, they're going after team's best prospects if they're going to sacrifice Buchnevich. So like, I don't think it's going to happen. And I wouldn't want to give up that proposed package I laid out either, but I think that's what it would take.
And just for the sake of argument, if Holland was able to pull it off, we talked about Toffoli being a great fit on Dreisaitl's right side. But if Buchnevich plays on Dreisaitl's left side, do you just move Kane over to right wing, or do you maybe elevate Holloway to that spot? And what makes Buchnevich an even more appealing option for the Oilers than Toffoli?
he's got a little bit more speed than Toffoli does. Like, he moves around the ice a little bit better. His 200-foot game is a little bit better than Toffoli's. Like, the thing you like about Toffoli is his shot, right? And, like, Toffoli is also Stanley Cup winner, captain of the World Championship team this year. So, like, he's got some leadership qualities. He's won before. But Buchnevich is just a better 200-foot player, and he's got a little bit more offense in his game at this stage of his career than Toffoli does. And you're right, the fit's a little bit awkward. He's a left shot. Buchnevich can play both sides, but he is playing left wing in St. Louis right now. So you're either looking at moving Buchnevich or Kane over to the right side, or you're looking at putting Evander Kane on the third line, which that creates its own set of issues.
Yeah, I mean, there are those aspects. I mean, it's nice that he can kill penalties too, so that that does help. But yeah, the Toffoli shot is a big thing. I mean, we just saw Buchnevich score a pretty nice goal against the Oilers a week ago, and you know, he finds the open ice, and you know, he has that one shot scoring ability. So I do like those aspects. A little bit of a bigger body too. So yeah, if they could bring him in, then that would work. It just seems like, if the package is that expensive, I would probably just check down and go for Toffoli instead, though, because if you can get a guy who is only marginally better for, or sorry, marginally worse for a significantly lower price, then you probably just want to go with that. I mean, you look at Buchnevich, 24 goals in 58 games. Toffoli has 26 goals in 60 games. Pretty comparable offensive numbers. I would probably elect to do the cheaper option and not send out as many assets in one deal.
And again, I'm looking at even strength points here. Like, Buchnevich has 35 even strength points this year compared to Toffoli's 30. So yeah, Toffoli's a little lesser than Buchnevich, but Toffoli at 30 even strength points so far is still pretty good. Yeah, I would not turn my nose up at that.
For sure. And those are definitely aspects to talk about, as we mentioned, with the power play opportunities being so hard to come by. All right. This is what we've been leading up to. Your number one trade target for the Oilers this year is Vladimir Tarasenko from the Ottawa Senators. Tarasenko is a veteran scoring right winger. He's 32 years old. He's 6'1" and 219 pounds. He has 17 goals and 41 points in 57 games this season. And he carries a $5 million cap hit and can become a UFA on July 1st. Ryan, what do you think the Senators are looking for in exchange for Tarasenko?
I actually posed this question to a friend of mine who's a very smart hockey guy, Senators fan. He said he would be happy if they got a second round pick. And I was doing a little bit of reading today that the Sens reported ask is a second round pick and a prospect. So like, I think we're in the ballpark there. So,
but not a high end prospect.
Not necessarily a high end prospect. It just said a prospect. Okay. So, and however much retention needs to be involved here is going to be a factor as well, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, are they willing to eat a contract?
Hard to say. They're not in a fantastic cap space situation. Like, they don't have. They're not in a position to be or weaponizing their cap space, if that makes sense. But I think they're still a rebuilding team. They've got a lot of good core young pieces, but I think they're still going to be looking for picks and prospects to bolster themselves for the years to come.
Yeah. I mean, it depends what they're willing to do. Like, if they don't want to take a contract, then they absolutely have to keep some of the money, because the Oilers can't fit a $5 million player, even with the cap that they've accrued. They have to be able to retain some of that. So, it just leads me to think, will the Senators find a team that's willing to take all of it? And would that be a more, you know, stomachable option for them than having to say, oh, okay, well, we're going to have to retain some salary to make this work for Edmonton? What kind of sweetener are they going to put in to make us want to do that? So we'll have to see how this kind of fits in ultimately. And, you know, the top three names on your list are all offensive-minded wingers, and that makes sense because it's been reported that that's the area the Oilers want to address the most. They're all former 30-goal scorers as well, and while Tarasenko does have the most high-end skill of the three, he's also the oldest and has the fewest of the goals between Buchnevich, Toffoli, and himself this season. So In your opinion, what makes Tarasenko the best possible trade target for the Oilers?
A couple things. Like I talked about Tyler Toffoli's shooting percentage, 14.7 this year. Tarasenko's at an identical 14.7% shooting percentage. And Tarasenko's at 12.8% for his career. So well above the league average for finishing. Tarasenko's a left shot, but he's a natural right winger, right? That's the big thing for me. Like, I want a guy who is naturally a right winger. Like, we're loaded on the left side. We need help on the right, right? So I want to make sure we're getting a right winger and one that knows how to finish. And the other thing with Tarasenko is he's got 33 even strength points, which is third on the list of available forwards at this deadline behind Buknevich and Jake Guentzel. So, like, of the cheaper plan B type of rental wingers that are available, I think Tarasenko is the best fit.
Yeah, no, and that makes sense. And because the Oilers already have three top six wingers in their early 30s in Hyman, Nugent, Hopkins, and Kane, do you think the Oilers should try to re-sign Tarasenko in the summer, or would the forward group be getting too old at that point?
That's definitely a fair concern. Like, even if you go to Foley, it's the same idea. It's older. It's a little bit slower. Ideally, you want to add a little bit more speed to your top six, but we're in win now mode. Like, these guys are still in their prime, although near at the end of their primes. And we're in cap space. We have cap space issues, right? So if you can get these guys to short-term deals with a moderate cap hit, I think that's going to be the easiest way for the Oilers to succeed here. They don't have high-end young players that are ready to make an impact. Holloway could in the future, but it's not happening this season, and it might not next season either. It might never happen, right? We don't know that.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think everyone realizes it, but the Oilers are actually an older team than some people might think. Like, you know, McDavid and Draisaitl are the two youngest in the top six, and they're both in their late 20s now. So luckily, you've got guys like Hyman who are having, you know, who's having the best season or best two seasons back-to-back of his career in his 30s. Nugent Hopkins seems to just be getting better with age, like a fine wine. So if they can bring in Tarasenko and he fits like a glove too, like, it shouldn't necessarily matter if he turns 33 later this year, because if he can still contribute at a close to 30-goal pace, like, what is he on pace for this year? I said 17 goals in 57 games, and that's without the benefit of playing with a guy like McDavid or Draisaitl. So right now he would be on pace for about 25 goals. Maybe you bump that up to 27, 28 playing with these guys. And if, like you said, if you can bring them back next year on a reasonable cap hit, it could work, because I don't know if they can find another right winger for the available cap space they have who can produce like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, there's nobody that's ready to step in right now. And the other thing about these guys like Toffoli and Tarasenko is a Stanley Cup winner, right? Yeah. He's been there, done that. And all reports out of Ottawa say that he's a leader on that team. He's a strong voice with the young players in Ottawa. So that's a strong dressing room presence that you want on your team when you're trying to win a Stanley Cup.
Without question. And the last one I have for you tonight, Ryan, is, you know, there's one name you didn't have in your top five, but he might be the best possible fit for the Oilers on the trade market. Should the Oilers pay the price to bring in Jake Guentzel, knowing it will almost be impossible to re-sign him? Or if the Oilers were able to acquire Guentzel and play him on Draisaitl's ring, you know, is that much better than what they could get with some of the other guys you listed, but for a way more expensive price?
For me, I mean, the reason you didn't make my list is because I don't think the acquisition cost is going to be worth it, knowing that we're not going to be able to re-sign the guy next season. I mean, yes, Guentzel is the best forward available. There's no question about that. Point per game player. He's got 39 even strength points. That's top of all my list here out of all the guys that are available. But if you're balking at the package for Buknevich, it's going to be a very similar, if not richer, package.
I was going to say, do you want to speculate on what it would be for the Oilers?
Yeah, like so Fogel would have to be involved again. 2024 first at a minimum. They're like, say goodbye to Dylan Holloway. If you want Gensel, buy Dylan Holloway. And you're likely saying goodbye to Philip Broberg too. Like, if the Blues are asking for that for Buchnevich, Gensel is a more valuable player.
And right. This is a player that the Oilers wouldn't even be able to re-sign, even if he wanted to. And it's unlikely he would, you know, as an American player from the East, very likely that he re-signs in one of those markets. So
yeah, and we haven't even talked about salary retention yet.
Exactly. So, I mean, it might be the perfect fit. And you'll see the odd person on Twitter saying, just do it, Ken. Whatever the cost is, make it happen. Bring in Gensel. I mean, if they won the Stanley Cup, then you don't care about what you had to send out to do it. But I just think that the assets that they would have to give, it's just so risky, and it could set your organization back if you just bring them in and it doesn't work, or they go out early in the playoffs or something. So I don't know. I would probably prefer to bring in a guy who can give you similar, even if a little less production, but for a lot less in terms of having to give up players and picks.
Yeah, and like there's lots of other options available. Like, I like Tarasenko the best and Toffoli next after that, but like Frank Vetrano is an option. Jordan Eberle is an option. Anthony Mantha is an option. Adam Henrique is an option. Like, there's going to be lots of guys available that are going to give us the results we need in the top six.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. And Ryan, I just want to say thanks again for being on the show tonight. Always great talking to you. Like I said, you've been on six times. We'll definitely try to have you back on at least one more. Hopefully, maybe even the playoffs would be a good time for that. And I know you've written a couple articles recently for heavyhockey.com about the trade deadline as well. Could you just quickly talk about that? And do you have anything else coming up this week?
Yeah, so I'm doing, it's going to be a four-part series on players that could be leaving the organization this week. So far, I've released pieces on Warren Fogle, Dylan Holloway, Cody Ceci, and Tuesday I'm going to be releasing a piece on Brett Kulak, so look out for that. I'm going to do a piece on potential trade deadline targets as well before the deadline, so keep your eye out on that, and of course I'll have a reaction to anything that the Oilers do on or before Friday.
That's awesome, man. We're looking forward to that. And where can people follow you?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter. My handle is at LotsRyan. Username is Lotsy. I'm hoping that's a little easier to remember for people than what I used to have on there. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
All right, everyone, please go give Ryan a follow and check out all his work at heavyhockey.com. You can also follow me at Eric J. Friesen. You can follow my podcast at 99 Forever Pod. Ryan, always a pleasure talking to you. Let's do this again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. It was awesome. Thanks so much, Eric.
Awesome. So for Ryan Lotsberg, I'm Eric Friesen. This has been the 99 Forever Podcast. We're out.